I'm Liz Grossman.
I'm Rachel Gilman-Rischel.
And I'm Molly Each. You're listening to the Between Bites podcast, a nonprofit food-inspired storytelling series. We feature first-person stories from chefs, restaurateurs, writers, and others in the food and drink industry. Episodes are recorded live in Chicago bars and restaurants. We hope you enjoy.
Okay, should we get started with some stories?
Yeah.
Okay. Our first reader is Kat DeOrio. Kat is the host of Check Please, the beloved WTTW TV show. She started out as an attorney but traded the courtroom for the kitchen. She's a formally trained chef and lifestyle expert, spokesperson, journalist, and public speaker. She's done over 600 appearances, that is crazy, on major networks from NBC to ABC to Fox and WGN, with spots on the Today Show and the Cooking Channel. She's been a spokesperson for major brands such as Sara Lee, Jimmy Dean, Godiva Coffee, and Crate & Barrel. She's written for a range of publications, including CS, Us Weekly, Michigan Avenue Magazine, and Eater, and even had a stint as an editor-at-large for In Touch Weekly. When not traveling the country to dish on the food scene, she develops recipes, consults on events, and stays on top of food trends. Please welcome the very awesome and very busy Kat DeOrio.
I think public speaker was an overstatement. I get nervous in front of live audiences, so bear with me. Thank you guys for coming. This is such a great cause, and thank you for including me. I'm very honored. It was a brisk, wintry morning when I arrived. Misty tendrils of fog danced above the Adriatic-filled canals in the chilled morning air. A blanket of gray settled over the city, and the damp air seeped into my travel-weary body. Venice seemed different than I remembered from visits past. As I pulled my luggage through winding canals to my pensione, I felt my bravado crumbling as fast as the facades. This was my new home. My work at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection would begin shortly. But until then, I had no apartment, I had no friends, and having grown up in a large Italian family, I was experiencing something more foreign than the country. I was completely alone. Now, Venice isn't Rome. Cute ragazzi aren't whizzing around on their Vespas looking to show American girls their hospitality. Venice is insular. Locals don't mingle with throngs of tourists looking to hit the big three, San Marco, the Accademia, and Rialto Bridge on a quick stopover. And at night, it's like an abandoned carnival with cats and rats the size of cats scurrying about. And yes, this may well come as a shock to all of you who know me, but I was quite literally at a loss for words. The language confidence I could summon was a bit of liquid courage, and my posse in tow had abandoned me. I wasn't self-assured enough to strike up conversations with strangers, so I would walk the city every night, stopping in Bacardi for wine and Cicchetti. I became quite partial to the early evening ritual of grabbing un umbro of vino, or in my case, a Prosecco. And it's here that I realized bubbles can and should be a daily occurrence. Shopping for vegetables at the boat market alongside the Ponte ai Pugni, partaking in the ritualistic 1-2 sip of cafe macchiato, espresso with just a spot of steamed milk at the bar counter, and visiting the markets gave me reason to engage. Soon, I had a place where everyone might not know my name, but they knew which tramezzini I preferred. I began to feel like everything was going to be all right. And then I started my job. So here I was, with a dream job and an even dreamier city. What could possibly go wrong? Well, it turns out when nearly 10,000 applicants from all over the globe apply for one of a dozen spots, everyone selected for a position at the Guggenheim is just as accomplished, just as driven, and just as competitive as you are. That first day of work was not dissimilar to the cocktail party the first night on The Bachelor. The only difference was these people actually had accomplishments to back up their attitudes. My time spent working for the Italian Renaissance curator at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., garnered a mere smirk from the modern art mavens, as if to say, Michelangelo? It's so about Max Ernst. I made no friends that day, but I gained a roommate, Juan Carlos, a kind and generous Spaniard from Madrid who became one of my dearest friends abroad. He taught me many things. One, if I was going to find a proper Italian boyfriend, I needed to know a lot more about football. Two, you can use olive oil for just about anything. And three, chocolate is the only way to start your day. The only problem, he spent an awful lot of time watching Real Madrid and Juventus and Man U and even the kids kicking a ball around in our back alley. So he was really hard to get out to socialize. And I had no other friends. The layers of cultures, languages, and customs created barriers to intimacy unlike any I had ever encountered. The loneliness I felt had me yearning for home. But with no return flight home, it became apparent that I needed to get to work creating one abroad. I'm Italian. To me, home is family and food. I had one of the two available, so I threw a party. I put my heart and most of my month's salary into it. I spent days shopping and cooking. All of my colleagues attended. We were poor. The food was free. And the postcard perfect views of the Santa Maria della Salute Church from my Grand Canal front flat lured even the iciest of the bunch. Location is everything. The party grew so large it spilled onto the campo outside. I fielded requests for recipes and swapped tips with other culinary-minded guests. Throughout the night, Juan Carlos could be heard repeating, "I didn't even know she could cook. I've only seen her eat coffee, carrots, and mustard." At sunrise, I served a bastardized cafe coretto of espresso and swill to a living room full of people. I stepped back, sipped the warm liquid, and savored the thaw of my chilly coworkers. I arrived at work to smiles and hellos. The party was a success. So much that even the mysterious rock chick of the museum, Tatiana the Croatian, with her jet black mullet, well-worn leather jacket, and the faint scent of a divey bar circa 1995, or current day Richards, said her first words to me. "Can you join for dinner party at my friend's home? He is a wonderful cook. You will enjoy." That evening, I was introduced to a group of Croatian expats and linguine with langoustines, served with the head and big, bulging black eyes staring up at me. This was the 90s. It was not something I had seen. Everything in American cooking was sanitized. In the States, the closest you would come to seeing the origin of your food was the sad lobsters awaiting their tragic fate in the grocery store tank. I wasn't even quite sure how to eat it. I was Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman staring at her plate of escargot. I paused, but host Ognan didn't skip a beat and jokingly announced a tradition of feeding all new guests in his home, which he quite literally did. Immediately, I was at ease. Dishes passed around the table, glasses clinked chin-chin, and despite stretches of Croatian conversation that I couldn't understand, I almost forgot we had all just met. For the first time since my arrival, I felt among friends. The Croats introduced me to Sabine, a Viennese girl who had a penchant for Croatian men. A dear friend of mine still, I learned that penchant extends to men. All men. Like the entire gender. With an appetite as lusty as her libido, she was a lively part of the dinner party circuit and soon became my dining out partner. I scanned menus for unusual things I had yet to try. She surveyed the osteria for men she'd like to try. Months passed quickly and my circle grew as we shared our past and hopes for the future. On the eve of Carnevale, as Swedish Anna whined into Aperol spritzes about romance with Davide gone awry, she would later meet her husband Dan at a dinner party of mine while he was making his famous eggplant parm. Sabine met a man who introduced us to the Venetian social set. The next few days were a whirl of black tie galas and 15th century palazzi and new faces. So many new faces. For the first time, I had too many options. There were the caddish Venetian boys looking for fun, the party girls who didn't remember your name unless you had an invite to the next soiree. And then there was Amira. Following 5 long days of festivities, fueled by champagne, 20-something energy, and copious servings of scrupini, very heavy on the vodka, the willowy girl from Tel Aviv invited me for brunch. I was greeted with a fragrant blend of onions, peppers, and tomatoes, punctuated with sweet paprika, spicy chilies, and warm cumin at her door. "I made shashuka," she said excitedly. I was like, "Oh, shashuka, huh?" I later learned it meant all mixed up in Hebrew, which was apropos since that's how Carnivale had left us. "This is what my mother makes me. She's French Moroccan," she explained. "It's my favorite. Try it. It's delicious." She was right. It's now one of my favorites. As we ate, she shared stories about life in Israel, thoughts on Middle Eastern politics, how fear, bombs, and shootings are a part of everyday life in her country. I did my best to understand, but I didn't, at least not then. As an American, Clinton's cigars and his creative uses for them were our biggest concerns. Dismissing puritanical American ideals, she changed the subject from current affairs to romantic ones. Enter Fabio. Every store set in Italy needs a Fabio. And no, I did not change his name for purposes of this story. We met during Carnivale. He mended my broken heart, and through him, I met my best girlfriend, Chiara. With them, we made Supper Club official. Each week, a friend hosted a dinner, each one teaching us a bit about the other. Fabio prepared ostrich. All I knew about ostrich was it was a material in the Prada accessories collection that year. I didn't even know you could eat it. At Alessandro's party, a wealthy Venetian gentleman who behaves as if he's on the set of La Dolce Vita took us by boat to a small island in the lagoon where we caught fresh fish and cooked it in an outdoor wood-burning oven. Platters overflowed with so many delicacies from the sea, small oily sardines, grilled langoustines that I now knew how to eat, and these tiny clams, caporosoli, which are unique to that area and rare. The night was as wild as him. Chiara's parties were always very proper affairs. She was adamant about the correct way to cook. And like most Italians, faithful to traditional methods with zero room for interpretation, I realized that Italians versed in the fine art of far niente quickly transform into something just short of a Gestapo officer when it comes to la cucina. Never use Parmesan with seafood. You wait for the risotto doesn't wait for you. From her, I learned how to make classics, like risotto con asparagi, lisi e bisi, and her way to a man's heart, pasticcio. On Easter, when I was so far from my family, I was in her kitchen making Venetian brioche with hers. This time was formative. It expanded my palate, my mind, my waistline, and by that I mean my ass. But it was a big butt by the time I got home, seriously. So through these dinners, we laughed together. Yeah, there was the time I intended to order rabbit coniglio, and I boldly ordered a dish of coglione, which means testicles, balls, much to the delight of my dining companions. And when Fabio confided his father was diagnosed with terminal cancer, we stared into our cappuccini and cried over cornetti in the early morning light, allowing silence to speak volumes. As each of us shed our protective armor and triumphs and tragedies were revealed, we slowly cemented a place forever in one another's hearts. These meals became the place we would gather to share our raw, vulnerable selves, unknowingly creating a seismic shift in our idea of home. In the city of masks, we wore none. On the eve of my return to the States, we cooked one last meal, eating, drinking, dancing, and laughing until bittersweet tears sprung to our eyes and we embraced through reluctant goodbyes. During this time in Venice, with the family I had created, I truly understood the common tie that binds us all together. The food we eat speaks to our culture, the experiences we've had, and brings us closer to understanding others. It is through breaking bread with others that I learned that even when you are away, you are only one dish away from feeling close to home.
Thank you.
So our third reader is responsible in part for starting the citywide addiction for crispy fried chicken slathered with honey butter. She, along with partner and past Between Bites reader Josh Culp, is the executive chef, managing partner, and chief high fiver of Honey Butter Fried Chicken in Avondale and founder of the Sunday Dinner Club. She and Culp make regular appearances at chef-driven events around town and have had their writing about food, business, and ideas published in Chicago Magazine. The two of them are true innovators in dealing with employees and how to structure a business. Please join me in welcoming Christine Sikowski.
Thank you, Rachel. All right. So there's a wall in my apartment that I write on, like actually write on. Landlord be damned. I took to the off-limits canvas like a kid does to candy. The rebel in me is somehow very satisfied in the moment when the colored pencil makes contact with the wall and I scrawl over its bumpy surface. The wall is one of four in a room that serves functionally as my office slash living room, but in practice it is my creative space. I go to this wall when I need inspiration, or I have something to say, or write, or something I want to remember, something I'm looking for, or something I'm missing. The wall is a collage of ideas, quotes, snippets of things I like, and tacked up pictures that have significance to me. Within all of them are pieces of home. Now, I lived in the city of Chicago for 22 years. It is home by definition and default. But I've never been able to find that sense of home solely in one place. To me, home is a feeling. I find it in people, places, objects. I mostly have travel to blame for this. Most people might call it a passion. A few call it an escape. To me, it is a calling, something I need to do periodically to feel whole. I travel when I can with respect to my restaurant owner schedule and responsibilities. But it's hard living this way. I always kind of feel simultaneously at home in a way wherever I am. A friend of a friend recently said it best. I have come to the realization that I will always be a little homesick no matter where I go. It's a blessing and a curse to love so many people and places. How deeply those words resonate. This wall that I write on has become a map of home to me. It allows me to be home and away at the same time. While there are no pictures of food, many of the images on the wall carry food memories. Food deepens our connection to our experiences, to that feeling of home. Rarely, at least for me, is it the direct connection, but rather a thread that weaves through it. So it makes sense that when I look at one of the pictures of a cemetery in New Orleans, I'm reminded of beignets. It's not as morbid as it sounds. I went to Café Du Monde with Nick, a former Honey Butter employee and now a very good friend. We met at the famous fried dough Mecca and caught up on life since he had left Chicago. I asked him why he had moved to New Orleans after only visiting for a couple of days, and he told me it felt like I was home. That struck a chord, and we delved deeper into that subject. We talked for hours late into the evening. Dense swampland fog filled the streets around us. It was very spooky. Powdered sugar concentrated on our fingers like paste, waiting to be licked off after the last bite of beignet was savored and swallowed. Café Du Monde was just one part of my experience there, and obviously, since a cemetery pic made it on my wall for a reason. But that powdered sugar magic is permanently imprinted on my taste buds, and in that picture as well. Because of my conversation with Nick over beignets about home, I found a piece of home in New Orleans. There is also a picture of rope swings on a beach in Tulum, Mexico, which I will forever associate with some of the most delicious food I've ever eaten and some of the worst Montezuma's revenge I have ever experienced. Do not eat the street food with raw vegetables. My business partner, Josh, taught me that afterwards. I have definitely found a piece of home in Tulum. Walks up and down that seemingly endless coastline soothe me during breaks from harsh Chicago winter. Across the road from the beach, the dining room of Heartwood is carved out of jungle trees and lit by candlelight. It is the restaurant that all chefs, including this one, dream about opening but rarely do because you'd have to give up your whole life and move somewhere off the grid and set up a restaurant with no electricity. Well, maybe someday. If you've never made the journey down there and savored their ceviches and honey beer glazed pork ribs and mezcal cocktails, please consider doing so. I keep the Heartwood cookbook at the top of the stack of books next to my wall. If I want to travel to Tulum, I just flip through the pages. There is an image of Lake Michigan, which reminds me of time spent in Milwaukee. Milwaukee is a great place to go if you want to get away but don't have the time or money to get on an airplane. I like to go to the lake to get perspective. It's the same lake as we have in Chicago, but somehow it feels different. Afterwards, I usually make my way to Honey Pie Cafe, and I always get the chicken biscuit pot pie. The buttery biscuit is golden brown crunchy on top and gooey, sticky, awesome, baked into the filling on the bottom. It wins the blue ribbon for comfort food. I've sat at that restaurant bar, picking at that pot pie, during high and low points in my life, and also quiet and mundane ones in between. That place is like a big hug that always envelops me and welcomes me home. Most people associate my restaurant with the crispy, crunchy fried chicken with melty honey butter that is its namesake, and rightfully so. But HBFC is so much more to me. It's a very big home. There are four images tacked together on the upper left corner of my wall. Each is a snapshot of the HBFC patio brick wall. I take the photo at the same time every year, in fall, when the leaves that crawl up the brick turn bright red. Each photo is a portal for a year's worth of experiences, looked at together. It is a series of benchmarks reminding me just how far we've all come. Flashback to 6 years ago. My business partner and co-chef Josh, our two cooks and one server, and I sat on my back porch, taking a few moments to eat a small taste of the food we had just served to guests at our Sunday dinner club. What happened that moment was not so much a happy accident, as we are quoted in the media saying, but a sloppy plate of family meal. But there we were, eating the fried chicken that somehow managed to land in some honey butter. It seemed so incredibly insignificant at the time, but I remember every single detail, the way the porch light dimly lit our quick family meal chow down between courses, where I was sitting on the steps, the sound of the dining room inside and down the hall. We bit into the first honey butter fried chicken and said out loud, "Oh man, this is really fucking good." Something compelled me to jump up and run to the dining room and tell our diners to put the butter on the chicken. And they did. And look what happened. From that moment, everything shifted towards now. 6 years later, I own a restaurant that has 40 employees who have a safe and nurturing work environment. Many of them tell me that it is home to them. We have thousands of customers, and I wonder if any of them have found pieces of home at Honey Butter. The first picture I took of the red wall was the day after we bought the building. That was before we had employees, customers, equipment, leases, exhaustion, good problems, and all that good press that connected so many people to our little restaurant that could on Elston Avenue in Avondale. Countless memories reside in the three pictures taken since. And all of this I can extract from four images of red leaves on a brick wall. If that is not the essence of home, I don't know what is. The wall in my apartment allows me to time travel while being present. I can zoom in and find the people, places, feelings, memories, and meals within. I can zoom out and see the big picture. When I move away from this apartment someday, I know the wall will get painted over. The photos will come with me, but the words I wrote will vanish beneath latex coats. And my home map will cease to be what it is. But for now, it is all of my homes in one place.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about us at between-bites.com and follow us on social media as Between Bites.